Welcome to the My Family Coach podcast. I'm Claire, and each week you'll find me interviewing a guest expert to find out more about the tricky world of child behaviour, all in handy 15-minute-ish bite-sized chunks. At the end of each episode, we'll send you away with three practical tips. It's perfect for parents, carers, and professionals working with children. And if this episode leaves you wanting more, you can watch, listen, and read our wide range of free resources on the My Family Coach website. I'm joined today by Clemmy Stewart and Dr. Emma Kell. Clemmy is an experienced school leader, having been a head teacher for 7 years, latterly overseeing two schools. Clemmy currently holds the role of leading learning and teaching across a group of 14 schools. Dr. Emma Kell has almost 25 years of experience as a teacher and leader in UK secondary schools and currently teaches in alternative provision. She's completed a doctorate on teacher wellbeing and parenting at Middlesex University and is also the author of two books on the topic of teacher wellbeing and is also about to have published A Little Guide for Teachers, Engaging Parents and Carers with School, which is really the topic that we're talking about today, how to build successful relationships with school. Enjoy the episode.
Hi, both of you. How are you?
Really well, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for having us.
No worries. Thank you so much for coming on today. I'm really excited to speak to both of you today about the topic. It's one that comes up quite a lot from our parent and carer listeners. And we're thinking about how to build successful relationships with school. Let's start off with, as we usually do, with a book recommendation. Emma, why don't you take us through that book recommendation?
Yes, we've recommended Matthew Said's You Are Awesome. I love Matthew Said anyway, full of common sense, but also challenging, but in a really gentle way, which makes you want to go off and be curious. So I love Matthew Said's books. You Are Awesome, bought it for both my daughters when they were 9 or 10. Not huge readers, if I'm honest. Confessions of an English Teacher, the shame. But they both absolutely loved it. And I think in this world we live in where children can be incredibly hard on themselves, incredibly self-deprecating. Some of the social media role models are frankly outrageous, and giving them that real resilience, that idea that hard work, perseverance, small steps, creativity, and being okay to make mistakes, just those messages that we're trying to reinforce at home, but you know they never listen to us as parents. So actually someone else giving them those messages that actually, you know, you are unique and you are fantastic and take it at your own pace, do it your own way. So love that book. And Clemmy's got a kind of partner book she would recommend as well.
Yeah, so when I was a head, we used to give our year sixes when they left us the book that Emma's just talked about, and also the Happy Self Journal, which then encourages children to start journaling some of those feelings that come out of reading books like that. So in a combination, they are just the ideal suggestion for children and indeed adults.
That's amazing, because sometimes you read things and then you're like, yeah, that's great. And there's loads of tips in there, but actually having the impetus to then journal about it, get some points down, because we tend to focus on the negatives, don't we?
Very much so. Very much so.
So easy to do. Now, I hadn't heard of that book, which is upsetting. So now I'm going to be like furiously Googling and having a look at it. But I guess that leads us on to the idea, and I think links in really well with the idea of well-being as well. So we are thinking about how do we build successful relationships, you know, with schools. Tell me a little bit about your experience with this topic. Clem, do you mind just going first?
Sure. So this is something that Emma and I both feel very, very passionately about. And it sort of started for me when I did a TEDx talk about snowplow parenting. And the title was, Does Snowplow Parenting Remove True Grit? And it looked at that sort of rise of the parent, the helicopter parent, the snowplow parent, all of those parents sort of forge ahead and remove any challenge from their child's way, and what kind of impact that might be having on our young people as they grow up. And I very much came at the topic from the perspective of a head teacher who was constantly working with parents who were just sometimes overprotecting their children and stopping their children from making those crucial mistakes that we all need to make and we all need to learn from all of the time. And we were finding through our research of our young children that by the time they were 17, 18, they were absolutely terrified of making mistakes. And of course, the impact of that as a young person going into higher education, further education, the world of work, any sort of next next step of learning was just so detrimental. And so we were looking at how we might be able to reverse that. And it's certainly something that, again, when Emma and I started looking at it for our data for the book, is absolutely stark in terms of the need for this, because parents desperately want to have a better relationship with schools. Schools desperately want to have a better relationship with parents. And yet there is this absolute gulf in the middle in so many instances where it's just not working. I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've come at this topic from, I suppose, three different angles. One is, I've been teaching for 25 years. For the first five, I was absolutely terrified of parents. I would do anything to delegate the task of talking to a parent in any context. Parents' evening, I remember actually, I think I was sick before my first parents' evening. I don't know what that was about, but maybe the enormity of the task, we have to do the best for your child, and my own sense of inadequacy. I'm also a parent myself. So I've now got a 12 and a 15-year-old. And it's funny how you know all the theories, but actually when your own child is leaving for school saying, "Mom, I'm not going to have anyone to sit with at lunchtime," your heart just breaks. And it's like that feeling of, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? So, you know, I'm blessedly lucky. You know, my children happen to be neurotypical. They happen to be very robust. They happen to take things in their stride. But even so, those moments of tears after school can leave me completely overwhelmed. And then finally, as a teacher, and I've been working, as I say, in teaching for 25 years, and I currently work in alternative provision. So these are children who have who are unable to function in mainstream school, and have fundamentally been let down by society and by the system. And that, I suppose, gives me this passionate sense of, I don't know, wanting to right some wrongs, and their parents, how closely we need to work with their parents to restore their faith in the system. So that's how I came at it, quite passionate from a number of different angles.
Really interesting, all the lenses that we can kind of step through as, you know, parents ourselves, but professionally as well. But I guess being on the receiving end of relationships that have been unsuccessful or been very challenging with parents, carers, but also having so many success stories where we've been able to break down those barriers. So I think it's going to be a really interesting different set of lenses that we can look through today. I listened to you
on that. What we've tried to do very carefully with this book is draw on those success stories as well as the more challenging situations we've either found ourselves in or we found in the research. And in fact, there's one case study in there that looks back at a child who had an EHCP and how closely the school and the parents worked together to get the absolute best for that child. And so we've tried to include those positive good news stories and try and unpick why they were successful so that parents can also use that in a positive manner.
Yeah, I mean, I literally, whenever I record the podcast, what I do when I write my questions, the first thing I want to ask is, like, tell me all the horror stories. Tell me where it's gone wrong. Like, oh, what can we do about it? But what I've tried to do, even doing these interviews, is actually start with the success stories and start with the positive, because I think that's such a good base, isn't it, to learn from, as opposed to constantly going through all the times where, it's been challenging. I suppose with that in mind, I'm interested in the kind of current context of relationships with home and with school and kind of what might be going on at the moment from your research for the book. So, I'm interested in that part.
Sure. Well, we wrote this at a time, I want to say post-COVID, but of course we're not post-COVID yet. We're still with it. But we were writing it at a point where parents had gone through that experience of having this hugely open window to their child's education, where whether they liked it or not, they were essentially teaching their children at home with the support of teachers at school. And they had this huge lens into the classroom and into those interactions. And I think that the lion's share of the feedback, certainly I was seeing, was hugely positive and respectful of what teachers do day in, day out, with people saying, "Oh my God, I could never do this in the long run." And, you know, hats off to all teachers out there. But then, of course, we all move back to how things are now. And I think that lens shifted a little bit again. But certainly what it's done is show parents, certainly their children, within the context of a wider class, a wider school, and it's helped them to understand better the exact point their child's at. And I think what we found in a lot of our research, whether it was through the verbatim comments or the quantitative data, was parents saying, "We want to know more, we want to be working in partnerships with schools, but we just can't access that information." So a lot of what we focus on in our book is guidance for educational staff on how they can keep those doors and windows windows to school open so that parents and schools can work in true partnership.
Emma, thinking about that sort of true partnership, maybe we could think about some of the successes that you uncovered in researching for the book around parents and schools, you know, really celebrating. I'm sure you've got loads from your own experience in alternative provision, which is so rich sometimes in those stories.
Yes. I mean, there were so many, it's really hard to pin it down to just one. And one of the things that we do write about is that actually parents' experience of engaging with schools is often so closely linked to their own experience of school. And when you think about your own, I mean, I know to this day, I can't walk into a food tech room without feeling this sort of shudder of panic, because food tech to this day, actually, Clemmie will tell you, food and all things related to cookery just make me feel really incompetent. So a lot of it is around really taking the time to build that trust and listen. You know, there's so much that we say in the book about be careful, school, because we're not saying schools are perfect. We're teachers, we're proud teachers, but we're not saying schools are perfect. Be careful with the language you use around parents. Don't talk in terms of difficult parents. You know, don't even talk in terms of hard to reach parents. If they're hard to reach, it's your responsibility to engage them. So the successes come when we actually start to really, it sounds so obvious, but see one another as human beings. This isn't the parents storming across the playground out to make you feel inadequate as a teacher. They will be angry for a reason. Give them the time, give them the space, listen, hear their story. Because if they're not attending parents' evenings or taking your phone calls, maybe it's not because they think you're a bit rubbish. Maybe it's because they're actually doing three jobs. Maybe it's because they've got three other kids, two of whom have special needs. Maybe it's because their mum's dying, you know, and actually just taking the time to hear their story. And then like so much related to well-being, you know, just checking in again, remembering, so seeing them at the playground, asking them how the new puppy is. So really that slow build of creating that trust. And in AP, we've had so many examples of your parents who just stopped answering the phone to school because it was always bad news. But actually someone at some point once phoned and said, actually, your child shows a real gift for creative writing. And the parent nearly dropped the phone because actually it was the first time, and this is a true, it was actually physics, the example was, it was a true story. A parent said to this teacher, you're the first teacher to ever phone home and say anything positive about my child. So finding time to say something positive, building up over time, listening to those parents, giving them space, remembering how they take their coffee. And often, you know, it's like the chimp paradox, often the parents' chimps are out, they just need to be heard. It's not about them needing you to find a solution now. It's them needing to see you as a human being who really cares about their child.
It's so lovely to hear that, going back to values, isn't it? Our values as practitioners, as parents, carers, about being humans, treating people with, you know, trust, care, listening to someone is so powerful. And the things that you're suggesting here and we're thinking about are not, you know, world breaking. They're not costly in resources or time. And it's both ways, isn't it? So I think, like you've mentioned in the research for your book and my experience working in alternative provisions and sort of special needs schools as well, is that there are so many parents that literally just coming into the school is a huge deal. Just actually being on site, you know, wondering, you know, it's triggering, for want of a better phrase. And I know lots of the work that we've done in those settings is building that trust and relationship, and going back to Emma's point, just building on the positives. It's such a naff thing, isn't it, to say just a small thing, building on the positive, but that's the starting point of finding the good. I think that's so important.
And breaking down that, you know, schools can be really intimidating places. Taking the time, one of the best pieces of advice I had as a parent was when you go, you know, ask to visit the school. Don't just go to the open evening. Ask for a separate tour. You know, schools are equipped for these, and go and see the toilets. find the toilets. It was one of the best pieces of advice. Where is my child going to be using the toilet? Because on a serious note, I mean, not going off on too much of a tangent, but on a serious note, there are children who do not use the toilet at school. And I'm sure you've heard about it, you know, and bladder problems that arise as a result. Go and see where they'll be eating. Meet, if you're secondary, meet the form tutor, the person they're going to start and end the day with each day. See that room, because once you can picture them in it, you that's where the trust starts to build. It's the unknowns, isn't it? It's the unknowns as a parent. I've worked in, well, I don't know, many schools, more than 10 schools, but walking into my daughter's school is differently scary. It really is somehow. So yeah, breaking down some of those unknowns.
I think it also ties in with what you were saying, Claire, about values. And in fact, in one of the sort of top tip sections that we've written with practitioners in mind, is be crystal clear about the values of your school and your setting. And whether you're the head, whether you're a governor, whether you're, I don't know, an NQ or an ECT starting off, be absolutely clear on those values, because every single interaction that you have with parents and carers should model those values, and you should be able to talk about them at length. And then parents should be choosing those schools based on those values, because if, let's take open mindset or growth mindset, if that's something that the school is espousing is really important, you as a parent need to back that as well. Otherwise you'll have a child that's hearing the narrative and the rhetoric of a growth mindset and embracing failure for the 6 hours that they're at school, but then they might go home to a family where failure is not acceptable and mistake making isn't good enough, and that will constantly be a clash for the children. So that clarity on values and an agreed set of values is absolutely essential.
So I'm thinking about values, and as a parent carer, maybe visiting a school, Emma's brilliantly talked about the toilets. I would advocate for looking at the office staff as well, reception, who's on reception, are they enjoying their job? That's key as well. Definitely. But also thinking about how do we find out about those values, whether they're lived and breathed? Because I find I go into lots of different settings in my role and they'll be laminated. I'm going to use a cliche. We don't want the values to be laminated. We want them to be lived. We could all join in with that cliche. But it's true. And, you know, cliches are there for a reason. But how does a parent carer kind of get the gist of what those values are and whether they're being lived and breathed? Because it's hard. An Ofsted report isn't going to tell me what I need, is it?
No, I think certainly for me, when I think back to when I was ahead, you know, with open events, we used to let the pupils speak at open events and then the pupils would do all of the tours, because I had an absolutely unshakable belief that parents needed to see what a year six child was like and whether their children might end up being like one of those children. And parents used to say to me, well, how do you choose the children to do the tour? I was like, I don't at all. All the children do the tour and they're not told what to say. And that, you know, every interaction was based in honesty. But actually, if you want to see the true meat and bones of a school, then look at the interactions. Look at the interactions between children, so child on child. Look at the interactions between children and staff, and by staff I mean all staff. Look at the interactions of the staff with each other, because that will tell you everything you need to know about the culture and climate of that school, not just the people who are doing their lovely laminated presentation to you but the people who acknowledge you as you walk around the corridors, the, as you say, the amazing people on the front desk. You know, all of those people will tell you everything you need to know. Is it a vibrant, happy place where people bring the best versions of themselves because they're doing everything they can for the children? Or is there something else going on? And those interactions will tell you everything you need to know. I really believe that.
I love that. I haven't thought of it like that. And I'm getting a bit blown away by the podcast, because the questions that I'd kind of, you know, had a little think about before interviewing were much more about, you know, what are the barriers? What can we do to fix it? But actually what we're talking about is enabling parents, carers to make choices on where their child gets educated based on those values. Like, that's really exciting, isn't it?
I think so. I think it's the most powerful partnership. And again, when we researched, the power of that partnership just sung through everything, came through the comments, came through the data. And we've talked, you know, to set various groups of professionals now who were just as excited and motivated by it. And actually you don't hear, oh, and then this happened and there was an awful situation. You just hear this desperate want for this to be a really powerful partnership. So the book focuses much more on how we can build that powerful partnership rather than negate issues and challenges. Of course, there's always some of that, but it's much more about what can we be doing in partnership to bring out the very best in every single one of our children.
I just wanted to draw us to communication, because I know that's something that you know, we kind of thought a little bit off air about, but thinking about parents carers that we have that are trying to work in partnership with school, what more can parents carers do with communication? I'm thinking maybe primary school, there's more opportunities for that open conversation, the nature of how parents carers might, you know, drop children to school. But as we get to secondary school, I think that communication can be a bit trickier. What do you reckon?
One of the things that I've heard directly from a parent that is incredibly powerful, and you can ask for this, is to have a named person. So many, many, many of the parents who got in touch with us for our survey and our interviews had children with special needs or who are going through emotional challenges. These will probably be a lot of the parents listening as well, actually. Well, I feel as if the school doesn't care. You know, it's this massive institution that's anonymous and frightening, particularly in secondary, which is my area. So a named person. Don't worry too much about hierarchies. If you meet someone in that school you trust, whether it's the office manager, one of the teaching assistants, one of the pastoral teams, or the deputy head, if you meet someone you have a connection with, ask for a direct line of contact with them. Because, and this is really important to say, there are a lot of flaws in the education system at the moment. I think I don't need to tell your listeners that. You know, teachers are under strain. They are time poor. You know, they're all of those. And they are under-trained, we think, when it comes to working with parents, which is why we've written this book, because many said they didn't feel equipped. But they do care. They do care. So that perception that they don't will have lots of factors behind it. If you're not getting anywhere with the grumpy French teacher, sorry, terrible cliche. I am a French teacher, by the way, so nothing against me.
That's loud.
I am a French teacher. Then speak to the form tutor. Find the person that you trust. And the other thing is around boundaries. You know, your time as a parent is precious. You're probably juggling 1,000 different things. Teachers' time is precious too. And the thing is that it's a wonderful job, but it is a job. So whilst during the pandemic, schools stepped into the centre of communities, remember everything else was closed, literally. Mm-hmm. Social workers were working from homes, home CAMs were working from home, GPs were not available to see in person. The schools were, and we quite happily and willingly as schools opened up, but that meant that suddenly 24-hour communication was possible. And I've been guilty of it. I found myself nearly sending an email to my daughter's English teacher at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night. It was a nice email, but I had to stop myself before pressing send. So do respect the boundaries of those teachers. You will get a response. If you don't get a response, then don't be afraid to take it up a level to the head of year. You know, give it a couple of days. Appreciate the teachers are actually teaching for most of the day. So their time to check emails, for example, is limited to probably 20 minutes a day, unless they stay very late. So respect boundaries, ask for a named person and share, give them the information they need. It's one of our top tips. Do your research. You know, teachers can only work with what they know. So give them as much information as you could. Don't assume that they know because you've told the deputy head.
No, that's such a valid point. And I think the other thing to say is, you know, certainly we've found, again, looking at the research of schools and school leaders and teachers, a lot of schools are making this a priority this year, and it's their strategic priority to build relationships with parents and carers and build that homeschool partnership. So watch this space, because so many schools and alternative provision settings and all sorts of different educational settings are making this a priority. So they'll be putting on events, putting on workshops. That will only work if parents then come to it. So I think we need to ride this wave of passion and enthusiasm and initiative and all pile in and help with it. You know, join the PTA, go to these events, build that network, and it can only get better. But if schools bravely put something on and no one comes, they're going to be unlikely to do it again. So I think it's got to be a case of working hard at it. We were saying earlier, you only get out what you put in. So I think it's got to be a big effort from both sides.
I think practitioners can find unconditional positive regards for children, young people, live values. And then as soon as that thought process switches to parents, carers, it feels like there's a disconnect, that it's harder to switch on empathy when it's parents, carers.
Yes, it is. And that comes back to the language that is sometimes heard in schools. You will get, I'm choosing my words, dastardly parents, and oh my goodness, and they're being really difficult again. And you do get, and that is actually, that's teachers' chimps coming out, because it's just another thing that they have to think about, that they have to deal with. And what Clemmie said about actually it is a priority in many development plans. We are strongly advocating it for it to be a priority in every development plan, because actually often amidst all the results targets and safeguarding issues and development plans and the marking and the feedback and the class planning and the displays, parents do get missed. Mm-hmm. And so they're coming in and it's just another thing. And it comes back to that gulf that Clemmie talked about. You know, we want the same thing, but actually when it goes wrong, it can go really, really badly wrong. And I spoke to a head the other day who was dealing with a horrible complaint. You know, they get escalated and escalated and escalated. And I said, you know, what are your reflections on this? Is there anything you would have done differently? And she said, yes, I would have listened more at the beginning. And actually, even though I didn't particularly feel that child's place should be moved in class, I probably would have given the parent that rather than let it build up into such a battle. So I don't know if that answers your question, but...
I think that's a really valid point. And I think the other issue, I was just thinking, listen to you talk with children, when every teacher, it's fully ingrained in them that no matter what, you never give up on a child. And then there's almost that slight power imbalance where you're the carer, you're the nurturer, you're the one that's guiding the young. Whereas with a parent, you're on the same level, you're peers, and therefore it can be a bit more personal. And I'm used to get so defensive of my children or my staff, whoever it was that a parent was complaining about. And luckily I learned the art of just taking a breath, walking away from the laptop, or planning a conversation with my deputy before meeting with a parent, because I knew that I had that kryptonite, for want of a better term. I knew I would get very defensive of my children and my staff. And I felt like I might have been being attacked by one of my peers, which just didn't sit right. And I think parents and staff have that, because they're on the same level, that they're being attacked by one of their own sometimes, which is how it feels. But I think, you know, as Emma was saying, teachers sometimes have that language around parents. Parents are the same on the WhatsApp group. You know, we've seen that too. And I think sometimes we forget how to behave. We forget to bring the best versions of ourselves to a conversation or to an interaction on social media. And I think sometimes we need to do what we say to our children, which is to use kind words. And if it's not true, don't say it, and mediate. We sometimes need to do that for ourselves as well. And I think the more schools can do that, the better it would be for everybody.
Yes. If there's one piece of advice, however tempting it is, if you're frustrated with the school, try not to take to social media. It makes it so hard to resolve something when, I don't know, the lunch queue's too long and my child isn't getting a proper lunch. Talk to the school. I know it's hard because if my child comes home and they felt belittled or humiliated in the classroom, my savage tiger parent comes out. You know, I have to give myself a talking to, count to 100 before I pick up the phone or storm down to the school. I know it's hard. But people can only deal with facts and what they know. And if, as Clemmie says, is it kind? Is it true? And really just remembering schools, nobody comes to work to do a bad job. You know, nobody in your child's school comes to work to make your child feel small or miserable. We're working within a system with huge challenges. But fundamentally, there will be someone in that school who can fight for your child.
And and I've noticed really that the theme coming out from most points that all of us have made have come back to communication, which I think is really interesting and very fitting. Just conscious of time, I'm almost running us to time, so that's not too bad. If we could just summarize those three tips just to end the episode, that'd be great.
Okay, so the first one is to ensure that staff are properly trained. This is actually a tip for schools, but I think it's important that parents know that we're advocating for that, that many staff, like me at the beginning of my career, feel very intimidated. They don't have the tools, they don't have the scripts, they don't know how to plan for the conversations. They feel that defensiveness that Clemmie talks about, which is so common in teachers, bless us. You know, we're not perfect. But make sure that staff are properly trained by experienced practitioners on how to, and that's another piece of language actually, not deal with parents, because that's another piece of language schools use. We're dealing with them, how to engage effectively with parents. Clemmie.
Number two is, as a parent or as a carer, to go into that relationship with an open mind. Now, whether that's starting off in the early years and it's your first experience of school, or if it's going into, I don't know, year eight after a particularly tricky year seven, wipe the slate clean, go in with an open mind. And if there's something that's particularly triggering for you as a parent about going into school, whether it's your own bad experience, or you've seen your child have a bad experience, or you've just got an innate fear of the system, if you feel brave enough, have that conversation with that key person and just warn them that that's how you feel and how it might present itself. And just remember, within that open mind, that the one thing that's linking you to every other person that you're going to interact with in that school is your sheer care and love for your child, because the school has that same love and care for your child too. And you are in a meaningful partnership. So just go in with a positive, open mind and see what you can build together.
And the final tip is around doing your research. We're not advocating that you go and read lots of PhD theses about working effectively with schools. We're talking about things like get into the school, meet the people, see the toilets, find out about the curriculum, ask questions, you know, ask probing questions. If your child's passionate about astronomy, ask for opportunities for explorations in astronomy. See what the schools say. If they say, oh no, we don't contemplate that, then maybe that's not the school for your child. So ask all of the questions, do your research, do your homework, and as Clemmy says, go in with that fundamental belief that actually everyone wants the best for your child.
That's so brilliant. And I'm really going to take away that idea of the values part, and actually parents, carers, taking control of analysing those interactions when they go, you know, for open evenings. And yeah, I think that's a really interesting lens and something I hadn't personally thought of. Just a thank you so much for your time today. Loads of great things that we've got out of that. And we'll put links to your book, which I'm excited to look at. I've got a little taste of it, of all the research in there. So yeah, thank you very much, both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for having us, Claire.
You've been listening to the My Family Coach podcast. Thank you for joining us as we lift the lid on the challenging world of child behaviour. Remember to subscribe to listen to all our episodes, and there's heaps more helpful support for all your parenting needs on the My Family Coach website. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.